Warning, if you're an attorney, this episode may contain high levels of cringe. Today we're talking about what can go wrong when lawyers use AI and why these embarrassing mistakes keep happening. Hello, you're listening to On the Merits, the news podcast from Bloomberg Law and Bloomberg Government. I'm your host, David Schultz. So a lot of people out there are saying that generative AI is going to totally change the legal profession, including the guest you'll hear on today's episode, Catherine Forrest, a former federal judge and current law partner and AI believer.
I am personally very excited about the potential for generative AI to transform the legal profession. I think it's going to and is already starting to transform the legal profession in really remarkable ways.
We've already seen companies create legal tech that uses Gen AI, including, in the interest of full disclosure, the folks here at Bloomberg Law ourselves. However, for whatever reason, sometimes lawyers use these tools incorrectly, or even more risky, they use consumer-grade versions of AI like ChatGPT. And when that happens, the results can be pretty ugly. In a bit, we're going to hear from Forrest about why lawyers should be careful using generative AI and where it can be most useful. But first, we're going to get into a few of the ways the lawyers have misused AI. And to talk about that, I have reporter Isabel Gottlieb, who covers AI and the law here at Bloomberg Law. Hello, thank you for joining me.
Hi, David.
All right, so let's start off by talking about the case that got everyone thinking about lawyers and AI fails, and that one is called Mata v. Avianca. So tell me about this case and tell me about what went wrong for the lawyers here.
So this case has really become the poster child for how to not use AI if you're a lawyer. Just a little bit of background on this case. The plaintiff, Mata, was suing the airline Avianca, saying he got hit by a cart during the flight. So the two sides were exchanging briefs when the lawyers for Avianca took a look at a brief that Mata's lawyers had filed and said, well, that's weird. We can't find some of the cases that they cited. As it turns out, the lawyers for Mata had used ChatGPT when they were writing their brief. They had asked it to help them find cases to cite. And as we're going to find out in the rest of this episode, ChatGPT is very prone to making up cases. Now, when the lawyers were asked to substantiate their work, they went back and asked the AI if the cases were real, and it said, yeah, yep, they're real.
And I get the sense that the judge in that case was very unhappy, which is a trend we're going to be hearing in a lot of these other cases.
Right. Now, the lawyers in this case will say they got in trouble in large part not just because they made a mistake. Everyone makes mistakes. It was the kind of the doubling down and not coming clean.
Yeah, and that was also something that happened in a case in Colorado last year where it was even worse in that I think the lawyer was caught doing something similar but kind of tried to hide it and said, no, I didn't use generative AI, but it sounds like, yes, he did.
Right. So this is a case last year, an attorney in Colorado named Zachariah Krabill, he used ChatGPT while working on a client brief, and wouldn't you know it, ChatGPT gave him fake cases. Now, he didn't verify the citations, and I will say this is an important pattern. It's not using AI that's the problem. It's using AI and then just sort of on blind faith, taking what it gave you, sticking it in a brief, sending it off to the court. This Colorado case, similarly to the Mata case, it was sort of a cover-up is worse than the crime situation. The lawyer in this case blamed the bad citations on an intern. He did come clean later, but he was suspended for a year. Mm.
But the next one that I want to talk about is something that I think is really interesting. And it involved a special education lawsuit against New York City. And in this case, the attorneys here won. They won the suit. And then they were asked by the judge to determine what their legal fees are that the city would have to reimburse them for. And that's where things got really messy. Why don't you take it from there, Isabel?
So in this case, the judge was extremely skeptical of the way that these attorneys had said they used ChatGPT to cross-checks, the sort of methodology for calculating their legal fees. The firm had come up with the number 113,000, and the judge said the appropriate number was closer to 53,000. I want to read you something, actually, that the court said about lawyers relying on AI, because in this case, the court is very clearly thinking about the cases that we just talked about and some of those earlier cases. So the court wrote, "It suffices to say that the Cuddy law firm's invocation of ChatGPT as support for its aggressive fee bid is utterly and unusually unpersuasive. As the firm should have appreciated, treating ChatGPT's conclusions as a useful gauge of the reasonable billing rate for the work of a lawyer with a particular background, carrying out a bespoke assignment for a client in a niche practice area, was misbegotten at the jump."
Mm. All right, so now let's move on to your conversation with that former federal judge I mentioned earlier, Catherine Forrest, who's now a partner at the firm Paul Weiss. Tell me a little bit about her background before we hear from her. She has a really interesting path to where she's gotten.
Yes, so Catherine Forrest, currently a partner at Paul Weiss. She's in their litigation department. She's also chair of the firm's digital technology group. And before this, she was a Southern District of New York judge. Now, Forrest has been interested in the intersection of technology and justice, technology and legal ethics. She's actually written two books, one of them explicitly about AI. She is very much sort of a voice in this AI and the law space. Part of what's interesting about talking to her is she's someone who actually really advocates for the use of AI in law and thinks it's going to be transformative to legal practice. But she also had some very interesting things to say about when and why it's not a good idea to rely on AI.
Yeah. All right. Let's get to your conversation with her now.
So, Catherine, thank you so much for being here. Really a pleasure to have you on the podcast. So let's dive right in. One of the big problems with generative AI's use in the legal field is its propensity to hallucinate or give wrong answers. Let's lift the lid on that a little bit. What's going on when the model does this? And also, by the way, why are they called hallucinations? Why aren't we just saying, you know, mistakes or errors?
Yeah, you know, it's the question that you've asked is a question that not only are practitioners, legal practitioners, and in fact, individuals all over the country who are users of generative AI asking themselves, but it's also a question that a lot of scientists are asking themselves. It's not really clearly understood why large language models hallucinate. And the choice of the word hallucination is because it's not just an error. It's not just leaving out a fact. It's sometimes actually replacing something with something that just doesn't exist and never did exist. And it's unclear exactly why. So there are lots of attempts to try and solve the problem without yet knowing its origin. And so we've got this situation on our hands where we know that these generative AI models, including those that are specialized for legal uses and really every domain, are so powerful and can do so many things, but yet they just like to make things up sometimes. So they're called hallucinations because they're something other than just a mistake.
And these are clearly not models that are designed to go get facts and give you facts. They're designed to do something else. What is generative AI for? What are they meant to do?
Well, the original design for large language models is to deal with language, really. They were designed to be chatbots. So it may not really be equivalent, and there's people on both sides of this debate, whether or not it's equivalent to reasoning or logic. Some would say vehemently yes, and some would say as vehemently no. And the no's say, look, these are large language models that are really just designed to give you the next most logical word, the sort of word that's missing. And one of the issues that people run into when they're using large language models for almost anything is that the models will give you an answer that will sound really, really correct. And so we can talk a little bit about it in terms of cases, but that's one of the things that for some lawyers has run them into big problems, because the large language models come up with cases and citations that are look like they're a correct citation. That citation indeed might even lead you to a case with that name. But when you read the fact pattern of the case, the large language model may have made up people and places and fact patterns and events and law that has nothing to do with the case in front of you.
For a lawyer using those tools, are there any red flags? Is there anything that the model spits out that would make you think, and I should say as a caveat, every lawyer using AI should check everything, right? The human should always be checking things. But is there anything that would make you really kind of go, I need to be particularly applying scrutiny to that answer?
Well, I think that when you're using one of the, in particular, and there are now a number of them, fine-tuned large language models for the legal profession, you really want most to use it in an area, if you're doing research, in an area, frankly, that you know something about, which is a little bit counterintuitive. You would think that you would only want to use the tool in an area of research that you didn't know anything about, so it could really help you the most. But the problem there is if you don't know anything about the area of law at all, it's very hard sometimes to pick out, this just doesn't seem right. So there's a base sort of knowledge that you want to have. So you can say, okay, this seems right. I get this. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, they've pulled out that case. Oh, I remember that case. And then you can go back to that case, check it, and you're absolutely right, Isabel. Every lawyer should always check the research that comes out. Nobody should ever be citing a case they haven't read. That's just dangerous and not fulfilling of the duty of competency that's a professional obligation for lawyers all over this country.
There's an interesting study a few months ago out of Stanford looking at the error rates for the big public-facing models. And one of the interesting findings was that the models were making fewer mistakes. They were more accurate on cases from the Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit in particular, and much more mistake-ridden on smaller and local court cases. What explains that phenomenon?
Well, I think that there is a portion of hallucinations which is based on the fact that the way AI works is it's pattern recognition in large data sets. And so the more that something appears in a data set, whatever the piece of data is, the more likely it is to be surfaced in an answer. And that's true for all of AI. And if you've got a smaller court, you're not going to have as many of those data points that will raise the particular legal sites up to the surface. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be, I think, more hallucinations, although, you know, in that case, it might even just be sort of an error and inability to find something.
What are some of the best uses of AI that you've come up with in your practice that you've heard about other people coming up with? Innovative, creative, effective. Let's hear it.
All right. So I am personally very excited about the potential for generative AI to transform the legal profession. I think it's going to and is already starting to transform the legal profession in really remarkable ways. I do think, however, it is not nearly at the level of capability today in 2024 that it's going to be at in a year, let alone 2 or 3 years. We're going to see a very significant velocity of change, and we're going to see the elimination, I think, of the hallucinations, and we're going to see far more capabilities than we're even thinking of today. So with all of that said, and with the caveats that we don't use it at my firm for outward-facing client work at the moment because we are concerned still with some of the hallucinations and things like that. But some of the great ways to use AI is for ideation in terms of legal work. So if you use AI for ideation, what you're doing is you're asking AI to help you with an idea, to formulate an idea. And it's actually really good at that. So if, for instance, you're a lawyer and you're sitting down and you're trying to come up with an idea for how to start a brief, you could type in a few words. I've got the following fact pattern. Here's the story that I want to tell. Here are the main arguments by the other side. Can you give me a catchy first paragraph? Another really great thing it can do is, for instance, you can upload a complaint and say, again, a public complaint, because you don't want to put anything that's confidential into one of these models unless you've really kicked the tires of the protections that you have. But you upload a complaint and you say, give me the best arguments for a motion to dismiss. And if it's the kind of case that appears with frequency, again, the pattern recognition will raise the observations up to the top and will actually be very good about coming up with arguments and good citations. And I've had it in an area of law that I know a fair amount about, antitrust. I've actually experimented with this and had really remarkable results. And then another one that I just want to mention briefly is, because I tried this as well, I was getting ready for a Ninth Circuit argument, and I was all ready, and I thought, well, let me just try this. So I wasn't trying to have the model do any prep for me. I was prepped, but I uploaded into the model public only versions of the briefs, and I knew the panel at that point. We were very close to the argument, and I said, what are the most likely questions that these judges will ask me? And because the large language model can read all the transcripts that are publicly available, it had, and came up with remarkably accurate questions. And so I thought that was a really sort of extraordinary moment. That was probably the moment that I realized that this is no joke. I mean, it did that exercise in seconds, and it would have taken a mid-level associate with an antitrust background a couple of weeks to do.
One thing I want to ask you, you referenced a couple of times as you were talking about the ways you were using this and kind of the guardrails around the ways you were using it, concerns about confidentiality, and particularly the concern that if anything is not already in the public domain, generative AI is not a safe place to put it. Can you talk a bit about that risk? What could happen if you're putting confidential information into one of these systems?
Yeah. So, you know, right now, a number of these tools have the ability to deploy what are relatively safe environments through an enterprise version or an instanced environment, as they call it, which is an environment which the administrators of a law firm can oversee and can see where things are going. But if you're using just a chat GPT on your phone, but the problem with using just what you can get on your smartphone or your computer with chat GPT-4 is that there isn't any confidentiality. And so what you've got is it's as if you're standing on the street writing out your question, if you will, and your answer is being written on the billboard. Now, not that many people are going to see it like that. So maybe you're, you know, out in Nebraska someplace doing that. But still, normally you wouldn't do that with confidential information.
That was Catherine Forrest, a partner with the firm Paul Weiss and a former federal judge, speaking with Bloomberg Law's Isabel Gottlieb. And that'll do it for today's episode of On the Merits. It was produced by myself, David Schultz. Our editor was Greg Henderson, and our executive producer is Josh Block. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Smart litigators find winning arguments faster with Bloomberg Law. Our market-leading docket coverage has AI-driven search and analytics, customized alerts, and expanded state court coverage. And that's not all. Visit pro.bloomberglaw.com for everything you need to win.